Hawkins Policy Radio, offering a unique perspective on everything. Geopolitics, culture creation, the reality of the world we live in. Coming to you live from New York City, your host, Pierce Redmond.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Porkins Policy Radio. As always, I am your host, Pierce Redmond, and you can find this show here at American Freedom Radio, AmericanFreedomRadio.com, as well as on my website, which is PorkinsPolicyReview.com. And over on my site, I have all the other stuff I do, the Porkins Great Game podcast, CIA in Hollywood, interviews, all that kind of stuff. So definitely check that out. Boy, today's episode, huh? I was just chatting with Danny, before we started the broadcast, and I was just telling him a bit of a rough week. I guess I'll start by saying thank you to Chuck Ocelli and Robbie Martin for joining me last week. That was a show that I'm very proud of. It did get sort of the response that I anticipated, so, people either loved it or hated it. But I think it's important to make those sorts of episodes and to kind of, draw a line in the sand, state, your beliefs, your morals, your whatever. I hope, people got something out of that episode. As I said, I know it was a bit of a mixed bag in terms of the response, but thank you to everybody who did appreciate the episode. All the great comments and emails and stuff that I did get about it. Very appreciative of all of that. And, before we kind of jump into the episode, which will be kind of related to some of the stuff we talked about last week, I do want to mention, thank you to all of my Patreon subscribers. So thank you, R&R, Joshua, Jacob F, Sally, Howard, Lee, Jake, Jess, Jacob W, Walter, Peter, Hassan, Janice, Quentin, Pamela, Arthur, Matthew, JC, Ben and Marianne, thank you all so much for becoming subscribers, for supporting the show. Of course, if you want to support my work, you can always go to patreon.com/PierceRedmond and you can become a supporter. Also, please, if you enjoy the show that you hear on American Freedom Radio, become a subscriber to AFR. You can sign up for a monthly donation on PayPal. You can do a one-time donation. It helps out a lot, and I know it helps Danny, who of course is the man behind the scenes with all this, who does a tremendous amount of work for all of us. And I guess in this sort of post-Thanksgiving time right now, I'm very thankful for Danny for the chance to do the show and for all the opportunities. So if you have a couple extra bucks, if you want to help support the AFR, you can do that, of course, at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. You can find the PayPal links, and you can start there. And the bonus podcast for PPR listeners has been recorded. It should, fingers crossed, be out sometime tomorrow, probably in the evening. I will try and get a little bit better about getting those out, at an earlier date. But again, just a lot of stuff going on here with the show and with my, work schedule and whatnot. But I think the subscribers will be excited. We spoke with Brian Heiss, who, of course, has been on the show several times before to discuss his research into the O.J. Simpson trial. And for this bonus podcast, Brian actually got a full copy of Nicole Simpson's infamous 911 call back in 1993. For anybody out there, this is the phone call where OJ has gotten into her house and he's screaming and ranting and raving, that's how the media has portrayed it. And Brian actually cleaned up the audio. You can hear very clearly that OJ makes numerous references to Nicole's drug use, to some of the unsavory characters that she is surrounding herself and their kids with. And Brian has been generous enough to allow for all of the $5 monthly subscribers who get the bonus podcast, they will also get exclusive access to the full 911 call in a video format with subtitles. This has never been publicly available in the long form. There's been little, you know, 2 minute clips that have been spread around the internet, but this is the first time that the full 911 call can be heard in its entirety. Brian, generously, as I said, will be allowing all of the subscribers exclusive access to this. And just to tease it out a little bit more, but in starting in the month of January, Brian has a very special surprise to all of my subscribers. So, you know, $1, $3, $5, whatever. Everyone will get access to some very exclusive material courtesy of Brian Heiss. So that's something to look out for as well. Now, what is today's episode? Well, I guess sort of along the lines of some of the stuff that we discussed last week. We obviously talked about Pizzagate, and I will try and not talk about it anymore because I'm just kind of done with that. But there's been a lot of scrutiny in response to the Pizzagate targeted at art, particularly modern art. Or contemporary art, I guess we could say. And I think this is like a trend that I've seen more and more popping up in the alt media, the alternative community, whatever. But particularly in with the Pizzagate story, a lot of scrutiny has been placed on artists like Marina Abramović, the Serbian artist whose name I'm going to butcher right now, Biljana Djurdjevic, who is the painter that Tony Podesta collects a lot of his art. You'll know what I'm talking about. These are the very kind of disturbing paintings with kids and dogs and other things. Not all kids. And of course, also there's been a lot of scrutiny placed on Louise Bourgeois, who is a sculptor and an artist, and people will be familiar with the sculpture, The Arch of Hysteria, that she made that hangs in the I think it's in Tony Podesta's house with his wife. And people have pointed to these artists as part of some sort of secret cabal, or that the art means something more. And I think there could be an element of that. I'm not dismissing that, but I don't think that, and maybe I might sound very snooty, you know, and like a real, you know, New York art person right now, but, and this is just my opinion, and you can, I guess you can target me later if you like, but I think that by and large, within the community, the alternative media community, I think there's a real disconnect when it comes to how they view art, particularly contemporary art, how they view the art world, and how the art world actually works, and why certain types of art have become so popular and so sought after. And I think this is especially the case with modern or contemporary art. And in that sort of vein, I was sort of thinking about that, you know, in the last couple of days. I thought that we could explore this a little bit more. And this is an episode that I have wanted to do for a while, but, you know, wanted to do a little bit more work on it. And admittedly, this is not going to be the fully polished version of the podcast that I envisioned. But I was just sort of at a loss for what to do. I was feeling a little kind of bummed out, this past week, and, you know, I didn't get a guest or anything. So I thought we could kind of explore this, and particularly the relationship between government or the state and the proliferation of modern art. And a lot of this does trace back to the Cold War, to the 1950s, and particularly with the abstract expressionist movement and the help and the sort of influence that the CIA gave them. And this is real. This is an actual thing. This is actually at this point now fairly openly spoken about. I was even openly kind of questioned back in the very late 60s and then into the early 1970s. People began to ask questions about this. And there is a link. And I think that in some ways, hopefully, that might kind of go towards explaining some of the art that we now see today. And but I have no idea because I didn't have enough time to prepare for all this, so it may not totally make sense. But I think this is still an interesting topic, and it's something that I'm very fascinated by. I am a big fan of contemporary art, of modern art. I do like a lot of abstract expressionist work, and of course I'm always interested in the relationship that the Central Intelligence Agency has with culture. And this particular case of the CIA getting involved in the abstract expressionist movement is interesting because it was done explicitly because of the Cold War. And I think no one can really deny that the Cold War never really ended, just as the game might have changed a bit. The pieces have been moved around, but we're still in that sort of world. We're still in that, we're still viewing cultural, political, economic, societal norms and viewpoints through the lens of this sort of unending fight between the West or America and, the East and Russia, I suppose. And I think that in some ways that might even explain to a degree why we see certain artists like Abramovich and others elevated to this elitist level. But anyway, I guess we can kind of try and jump into this episode. So I am going to basically be reading through and sort of most of this is coming from an excellent book called The Cultural Cold War, The CIA and the World of Arts and Letters, and it's by Francis Stoner Saunders, who's an amazing, amazing academic. I can't recommend this book enough. It's a really fantastic book. I think in the UK it is called Who Paid the Piper? And then there's a subtitle to that I can't remember. But in America it's called The Cultural Cold War, The CIA and the World of Arts and Letters. And Frances Stoner Saunders is someone that Tom and I have used a lot of her work in the past. Both from this book and from articles that she's written about the CIA's influence in the Cold War. The Cultural Cold War is a huge book. I haven't actually had a chance to read all of it yet, but I have used it recently for the article that I'm writing that I know I've spoken about on the bonus podcast, and I'll tease it out a little bit here, but myself, Tom, and a bunch of other people who you will definitely recognize by name and some you won't, we are writing we're all writing a series of articles that will be in an academic journal, all based around the CIA and Hollywood phenomenon. So I've used Saunders' book quite a bit. Excellent book, very well researched, and she's very, very reasoned in her approach to all of this. So I'm going to be kind of going off of my notes, and this is the new, I have the brand new edition. I think it came out maybe a year or two ago, and this is mostly coming from chapter 16, which is called Yankee Doodles. But let's kind of get into this. So at the end of World War II, and we're talking now the late 40s, 46, 47, in the aftermath of all of this. Suddenly Russia became our enemy, was no longer our friend, and the political, ideological, the cultural lines were drawn in the sand very fast, and you get the sense of that from reading Saunders' book in particular. And in a lot of ways this was sort of the birth of definitely of the American Empire, definitely of the intelligence state in America. But in a lot of ways, I think, after World War II, when we had essentially won and we were now in a position to exert the American Empire, we kind of began to reinvent ourselves as a nation, as a superpower. And there were lots of aspects to this that were sort of new to the American public. And the CIA went about poking and prodding and massaging certain elements and suppressing certain elements and pushing particular cultural norms. Now, when it came to modern art, which definitely, you know, became what it is in the, you know, starting in the late 40s, it was viewed very negatively by much of the public, and including people like President Truman. And President Truman was a big art fan. He would he was notorious for waking up very early in the White House, and he would go to the National Gallery, and he, you know, this all obviously it was closed, but you know they let him in, and he would spend a few hours sort of wandering around the National Gallery before. Before it was open, before the day would get started, and he had a great appreciation for art, although not when it came to modern art. And this is a quote from President Truman's diary, which is I think kind of illuminates this point. Of course, I now have to find it. Oh yeah, so this is from Truman's diary, and this is after. Gazing at some Rembrandts and others, you know, some of the great masters, he wrote this: "It's a pleasure to look at perfection and then think of the lazy, nutty moderns. It is like comparing Christ with Lenin." He would later go on to say, referring to the Dutch masters, the Dutch masters make our modern day daubers and frustrated ham and eggs men look just what they are. So this is, you know, a precedent set by the president himself, that this, the moderns were, I guess, like Lenin, and the, you know, great masters like Christ. So obviously setting up the sides in this argument. And of course, Truman was not the only one. There were lots of other people in government that were very antagonistic towards modern art. One of the more famous people is a Republican congressman from Missouri, George Dundero, who was very antagonistic. He believed that quote, all modern art is communist, and he would even kind of like go on. He said, quote, "Cubism aims to destroy by design disorder. Futurism aims to destroy by the machine myth. Dadaism aims to destroy by ridicule. Expressionism aims to destroy by aping the primitive and insane. Abstractism aims to destroy by the creation of brainstorms. And surrealism aims to destroy by the denial of reason." And he said these things and other strongly worded statements actually, on the floor of Congress. There was this sentiment amongst the public, but also echoed by people in government, that modern art was dangerous, that it was communistic, there were even people that floated the idea that there were secret messages in the paintings disclosing locations of government facilities. So I guess the idea being that you had some, abstract painters painting whatever, and this was really a code for their KGB handlers back in Moscow. Now, and of course, the idea that the Kremlin, that the Russians were controlling this, and this actually couldn't be farther from the truth, as we will see. Now, much of the brunt of these attacks were aimed at the abstract expressionists, and so we're talking about people like Jackson Pollock, Willem de Kooning, Georgia O'Keeffe, and a whole list of other people. I'm not going to, list all of them, but you can look up the abstract expressionist movement. Mark Rothko, another very famous expressionist. Now, many of these artists had been involved in left-wing politics. A lot of them had worked for the Federal Arts Project under the New Deal. So they were viewed as, lefties or, pinko commies. They espouse those sorts of ideas. They attended meetings and things like that. So again, amongst the public, which sees communism and the Soviet Union as this great threat, the connection that the abstract expressionists had was kind of detrimental to them, or at least in that sense. Now, interestingly, the CIA had a different opinion of this. they saw abstract expressionism as anti-communist, that this was really the ideology of freedom and free enterprise, which is a very big component to this. They saw this as, you know, if you look at the Soviet Union, it was all of that art was about realism, you know, Soviet realism. So you can look up, you know, Soviet era paintings and stuff, and it's all, you know, they almost look very much like, you know, advertisements. It's all realism. It's all about the, you know, the plight of the workers and defeating, you know, the bourgeois capitalists and whatnot. And nothing like, say, a Jackson Pollock, which is, you know, to, you know, dripping paint on a giant canvas. And again, this was very much also the abstract expressionism, very important. This is a mostly an American creation. This is very opposite of the European aesthetics and very opposite to the art that was popular in Europe. And that's not like a complete, you know, it's sort of a generalization. But for all intents and purposes, let's think of abstract expressionism as an American phenomenon. Now, we'll skip that. Sorry. Now, basically, though, the CIA did see this as the opposite. As I said, this was an idea of freedom. This was the liberty to create whatever kind of art that you wanted to. Whereas in the Soviet regime, it was tightly controlled by the state. So the CIA saw what was going on in the abstract expressionist movement as the polar opposite to this. So therefore, they wanted to, get involved. And the government in general wanted to get involved in this. And again, too, there was this sort of myth is created about, you know, what a true American artist was supposed to be about. And, you know, Jackson Pollock definitely fit into that kind of mythos. So you know, Pollock is always kind of described as this almost like this cowboy figure. You know, he's hard drinking and, you know, smokes a lot and he's the freedom to do whatever he wants to do and he doesn't take shit from anybody. And this creates this sort of, again, this ideal of what, not only what the American artist is, but what the American is, what the American represents. So this is a very powerful tool that the, government saw and essentially wanted to advance. And this began with the State Department, and this began very openly. The State Department did put up money and stuff for several exhibits in the late 40s, 47, 48, that was going to advance the abstract expressionist movement and modern art as a whole. Now, this did kind of run into some serious roadblocks because of people like Congressman Dodaro and others who, again, viewed this as communist art. Excuse me. So at one point, the State Department had an exhibition about 1947 called Advancing American Art. It was going to tour through Europe and Latin America. This included works of people like Georgia O'Keeffe, Adolf Gottlieb, Archibald Gorky, again, very, very famous, very prominent people in the abstract expressionist movement. Now, the show didn't make it past, I think, Paris, because of the ire of, people at home who didn't want America to be seen as promoting this left-wing kind of stuff. And actually, the show was canceled, in Paris, and the art was sold at a 95% discount as government surplus. So this kind of, you know, again, illustrates how involved the State Department was. They were actually selling off this art as government surplus. And again, it was pointed out that many of these artists had dabbled in left-wing politics. The State Department stated that no American artists with communist or fellow traveling associations would be exhibited at the government expense. And essentially, the State Department was kind of shut out from promoting this stuff. So, eager to showcase American art and culture, the State Department, the government, turned to the recently formed CIA. CIA, again, formed by President Truman, 1947. And this um, this is a very, you know, interesting step in terms of the CIA sort of culture war, which again began almost at the inception of the CIA. And it's also very interesting too, because this is another example of the CIA, cozying up to left-wing politics. Now, and this isn't just, you know, I know that I'm sure people listening to this are, oh, this is, you know, the cultural Marxists, at the CIA who took over. But, you know, let's not kid ourselves. The CIA loves fascists too. And while they were, promoting, left-wing artists, they were, of course, funding right-wing fascist militias all over Europe. You know, that's like Project Gladio, Operation Gladio. You know, they overthrowing Mossadegh and, all that sort of, so it's a mixed bag. It's a, and again, that's what makes the CIA, you know, very, interesting to look at. But, and the point man for, much of this, was a man called Tom Braden, who was, actually got cut his teeth in OSS, the precursor. He was later the head of the, International, Organizations Division, which was a subsection of the Office of Policy Coordination. He worked very closely with Alan Dulles. People might know Tom Braden. Some of the older listeners might be familiar with CNN's Crossfire with Pat Buchanan. Tom Braden was the other guy, the left-wing guy, on that show. And he was very influential in terms of the infiltration of the left wing. He's famous for being quoted in the Saturday Evening Post as saying, "I'm glad the CIA is immoral," and this was in reference to you know, like Students for Democratic Association. I can't remember the name. The CIA infiltrating that and other things of that nature. And Tom Braden was also the executive secretary of MoMA, of the Museum of Modern Art, and we'll get to that later. But through his, while heading the International Organizations Division, he oversaw the creation of things such as the Congress for Cultural Freedom. It's a very influential, very infamous CIA front that was originated in Germany, but was later, the headquarters was in Paris. And this was a front that the CIA used to promote, cultural things. So art, music, writing, criticism, all these sort of things. They used, the CCF as a front for all of this. And again, and the CCF would put up money for these sort of things. But anyway, Tom Braden oversaw a lot of this, and Tom Braden, was sort of the point man for all of the sort of, cultural and art stuff, but very much so when it came to modern art. And, again, I'll read you another quote, from Saunders' book, and this is Braden, responding to the kind of pushback from people like Congressman Dundero. So this is a quote: "We had a lot of trouble with Congressman Dundero. He couldn't stand modern art. He thought it was a travesty. He thought it was sinful. He thought it was ugly. He put up a heck of a fight about painting, and he made it very difficult to get Congress to go along with some of the things that we wanted to do. Send art abroad, send symphonies abroad, publish magazines abroad, whatever. That's one of the reasons why it had to be done covertly. It had to be covert because it would have been turned down if it had been put up to a vote in a democracy. In order to encourage openness, we had to be secret." And I hope that quote, you know, kind of sinks in, because that's very much the kind of thinking that the CIA has when it comes to their promotion of, quote, democracy and freedom. In a democracy, the people would never want this sort of art. So we had to do it secretly. We had to influence them covertly. And Saunders has a great little quote here as well that I'll read. And she says, "Here again was that sublime paradox of American strategy in the cultural Cold War. In order to promote an acceptance of art produced in and vaunted as the expression of democracy, the democratic process itself had to be circumvented." So, you know, very, very interesting ideas again. So, as I said, the government turned to the CIA, and the CIA did what it usually does, and it turns to the private sector to achieve these objectives, to promote this sort of art. Now, chief among them, of course, was the Rockefeller family and MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art, which was, you know, the Rockefellers basically, you know, helped create it. They funded it. Nelson Rockefeller was the president throughout the 1940s and 50s. The Rockefellers, too, interestingly, like a lot of these rich elites, were very familiar with funding left-wing artists. So, you know, the Rockefellers, for instance, did give money to Diego Rivera. And he created these, you know, very, you know, workers' rights, left-wing murals. And of course, you know, the Rockefellers kind of hated him for that, but they were familiar with, the idea of funding these sort of left-wing things. And now, and then again, this is what the Rockefellers were also key with, again, was helping to, again, reshape America, which always, you know, art is always funded by rich people. That's just the reality of the art that we know of. Generally speaking, you know, you look at the Medicis, look at the Rockefellers, look at all those sort of things. There was a time right now when that was not happening. You know, in the post sort of World War II, entering into the Cold War, there was, perhaps a disconnect, between that. And the people that were running the CIA, again, you've got all of these sort of, you know, Ivy Leaguers, rich, the sort of, you know, almost aristocratic, type people. They wanted to, you know, promote this stuff. They wanted to, push this. And here's another. I know I'm reading a lot of quotes to you, but I just kind of want to kind of flesh this out a little bit. But the idea of this was actually articulated back in 1939 in an article in Partisan Review, which also at one point took money from the CIA and the Congress for Cultural Freedom. And this is by Clement Greenberg, who was a very influential art critic. He did probably more than anyone else, you know, one person to put abstract expressionism on the map. And he also kind of created this ideological rationale for, you know, promoting this and for people becoming patrons of this movement. And anyway, he said that the avant-garde had been abandoned by those to whom it actually belongs, our ruling class. In Europe, traditionally, support was provided by, quote, an elite among the ruling classes, from which the avant-garde assumed itself to be cut off, but to which it had always remained attached by an umbilical cord of gold. So, again, we have the art world, sort of the avant-garde, the abstract expressionism movement, seeming to be kind of cut off from this, again, based on their politics, based on their ideals, their moral values. And what Greenberg is saying is that, again, we need to emulate our, you know, former colonial overlords in Europe, and we need to embrace, as a ruling class, we need to be upfront with this. We need to be funding this, and we need to be directing it. And essentially, he asserted that this had to be the American model, that the elites within America, like in Europe, they need to direct this art. And Tom Braden liked Greenberg's approach a lot. And he wrote about it, he talked about it with people, and he believed that art could only survive because of the rich and the powerful, and that they had a duty to instruct and educate, you know, what he would refer to as the ignorant masses. So very, very important idea again. You know, I said at the beginning of this, that, you know, in many ways, this was a rebirth, or this was a new sort of creation of America, a new version of America. One in which people like the Rockefellers and MoMA and other influential people behind the scenes had to make sure that this type of art became popular and that it was supported by the rich and the powerful. So as I said, the CIA turned to MoMA to achieve much of this. And I'll just sort of run down some of the connections, because like MoMA is, you know, I'm sure anyone that's, you know, from New York or visited New York has probably gone to MoMA. It's very interesting. It's almost like a who's who, of CIA spooks and intelligence people. So as I said, Nelson Rockefeller was the president of MoMA, from the 1940s to the 1950s. During World War II, He ran the wartime intelligence agency for Latin America, which was known as the CIAA, the Coordinator of Inter-American Affairs, which is, interestingly, as a side note, is the CIAA is also named in a very famous OSS memo from 1943 on motion pictures. And the Coordinator of Inter-American Affairs was seen as another one of these sort of subsections that they could use to influence films and get the CIA involved more and more in motion pictures. Now, by the early 1950s, Nelson Rockefeller was receiving briefings on covert activities from Alan Dulles and Tom Braden. In 1954, Eisenhower appointed Rockefeller as his special advisor on Cold War strategy, replacing C.D. Jackson, a very prominent Cold War here. And he was also a chairman of the Planning Coordination Group, which oversaw all National Security Council decisions. And the Planning Coordination Group was also involved in CIA covert operations. So Rockefeller, again, perfect sort of person. He has a history with these people, and he's a very influential museum with which to promote this stuff. Now, another interesting character, longtime trustee of MoMA, who is also the chairman of the board at MoMA, is a guy called John Jock Hay Whitney, who is a close friend of Nelson Rockefeller. He was the director of Rockefeller's motion picture division at the Coordinator of Inter-American Affairs from 1940 to 1942. So Whitney had some experience, you know, working in film and propaganda. He joined OSS in 1943. He was captured in southern France by the Nazis in 1944, and he actually escaped, a very dramatic escape on train. Now, after the war, he set up J.H. Whitney & Company, which promoted free enterprise by getting financial backing for underdeveloped or risky businesses, which otherwise wouldn't be able to get any money. And through J.H. Whitney and Company, he was able to, you know, give financial backing to artists, and essentially was a CIA cover. But again, that idea of free enterprise too, that's a very important factor in the abstract expressionist movement as it progressed. It was also, you know, it was seen as, you know, these people, they could sell it to anybody. They could ask, you know, exorbitant prices for the art. So very important to understand that. Hey, Whitney, again, as I said, very close with Rockefeller, and knew this world and knew how to use it. William H. Jackson, who was Whitney's partner in this free enterprise organization, was also a former deputy director of the CIA. And Whitney himself also held a position on the National Security Council's Psychological Strategy Board. So again, very, you know, the MoMA is, it really is this like who's who, but it doesn't end there. William Burden, who was MoMA's chairman of the advisory committee in 1940, in 1947, he was the chairman of the Committee for Museum Collections. In 1957, he was the president of MoMA. He also worked under Rockefeller at CIAA, and he was also, William Burden was also the president of the CIA's Fairfield Foundation. And the Fairfield Foundation, again, is a CIA front, very involved in the Cultural Cold War, very involved in putting up money for modern art exhibitions. And we'll get a little bit more to the Fairfield Foundation later. Now, another very interesting character at MoMA was René de Harnoncourt. I hope I pronounced that right. He was in charge of museum operations. Now, what did de Harnoncourt do? He also worked, again, at Rockefeller's CIAA Arts Division. He consulted for the National Security Council Operations Coordinating Board, which is what the Psychological Strategy Board became. He regularly reported to the State Department, and according to William Barden, was most likely the agency's main contact at MoMA. So on a day-to-day level, you know, they're not going to call up Nelson Rockefeller every 5 minutes asking them something. But de Harnoncourt was the agency's sort of go-to person. And of course, too, you know, William Paley of CBS was a MoMA trustee, as was Joseph Werner Reed, who was, again, at the Fairfield Foundation. A really interesting character, Yvetta Culp Hobby, was a founding member of MoMA. She was also on the board of the Free Europe Committee. Her family's foundation was used as a CIA conduit for money to be, funneled into different arts exhibits and things like that. And while she was while he was the secretary for health and welfare under Eisenhower, her secretary was Joan Barden, who previously worked for Nelson Rockefeller and was, of course, married to the CIA's Tom Barden. Joan Barden was also Nelson Rockefeller's executive secretary of MoMA from 1947 to 1949. So I know that's a lot of information. You might have to go back and re-listen to some of that. But just kind of want to set up the idea that MoMA itself is I don't want to say CIA front necessarily, but it was because, I mean, there were people there that were either unaware or, you know, truly just cared about modern art. But the people at the top, the people that really made decisions on all of this stuff, very well connected to the CIA, to the intelligence state. And the CIA turned to them for an obvious reason. So suddenly, in the 50s, MoMA begins promoting the abstract expressionists almost to a, you know, startling degree. And there were a lot of people that were actually kind of pissed off about this too, because the abstract expressionists were kind of given like preferential treatment, over all these things. But basically what you do is you've got MoMA promoting them. So, you know, all of these famous artists, their artwork hangs in MoMA. MoMA has exhibitions. MoMA begins sending a lot of the, shows of various abstract expressionists to Europe. So they tour around Europe. Then you get groups like the Congress for Cultural Freedom. So what does the CCF do? Well, the CCF will sponsor an art exhibition, or they'll sponsor an art competition. Okay, so they'll set up an arts competition, and then you'll have groups such as the Fairfield Foundation fronting the prize money for these. And of course, you know, who is the prize is going to go to, some abstract expressionist. And that's not to sort of like, you know, discourage them. They were making great art, but you do have this interesting group of people that are in the shadows, kind of beginning to direct it and kind of beginning to push it in a certain way. And what kind of, you know, so we have that in mind, right? I think we've established that, let's say, that this is a phenomenon. This is something that was going on. Now, what happens to this art? What happens to the people involved in making this sort of art? Because now suddenly, you've got this movement which was spontaneous, okay? And that's a big distinction. That's a distinction that Saunders makes throughout her book. Whenever she's talking about, you know, be it, you know, modern art or, you know, classical music or things like Encounter magazine even and some of these other things, there were people there that truly were just, you know, doing this. It was always going to happen. And I think there's a desire or reaction in a lot of, you know, alternative circles to say that, oh, the CIA created modern art. Well, no, they never created modern art. Pollock, de Kooning, Gorky, Rothko, Louise Bourgeois, all these people would have existed no matter what. And they were making this art. But the government saw that there was maybe some sort of benefit to getting involved in this. But I think something kind of interesting happens with this. So you have this desire by a group of elites that they want to become kind of almost like the Medicis of their time. They want to instruct the masses. They want to educate them that this is the art that we all need to care about. That this is good. And they begin that influence, I think, almost begins to take on its own momentum, and it kind of takes on its own form. And a lot of these abstract expressionists who had left-wing views begin to change. So you start to see them politically changing. You start to see them beginning to despise the Soviet Union. You start seeing them beginning to, want to challenge the Soviet Union. That in the Soviet Union, you can't create, art anymore. That everything is sort of controlled. And again, there's this push at the same time by many people in the government to, again, to continue to push modern art as the sort of art of liberty. President Eisenhower himself once referred to modern art as, quote, a pillar of liberty. And he even addressed in an address where he was basically sort of directed at MoMA, he said, quote, as long as artists are at liberty to feel with high personal intensity, as long as our artists are free to create with sincerity and conviction, there will be healthy controversy and progress in art. How different it is in tyranny when artists are made the slaves and the tools of the state. When artists become chief propagandists of a cause, progress is arrested and creation and genius are destroyed. Now, very interesting he's saying that while, of course, you know, they were actively involved. The state was actively involved in the U.S. with, you know, pushing these artists, with promoting them, with making them become the sort of the ultimate art, you know. And again, this idea that modern art was about liberty, it's about free enterprise. Now that idea, I think, is more a creation of the CIA. I think that, you know, the abstract expressionist movement was not designed as this, they didn't all sort of sit around and say, oh, you know, we're going to make liberty, art or something like that. And, you know, along the same line, people like George Kennan, echoed, very similar stuff on, you know, what he referred to as free art ideology. And he was constantly kind of criticizing Moscow and he put out the idea. He told an audience of MoMA activists back in 1955 that they had a duty, quote, to correct a number of impressions that the outside world entertains of us, impressions that are beginning to affect our international position in very important ways. And then he went on to say, the totalitarians recognized that only if they appeared outwardly to enjoy the confidence and enthusiasm of the artist could they plausibly claim to create a hopeful and credible civilization. And I find it sad that they should have to come to this appreciation so much sooner than many of our own people. So again, the government is not only funding this to a large degree, they're not only helping to make sure that it becomes very chic to appreciate modern art, but they are creating this idea that it is a battle, that this is even the Cold War is even going to affect modern art, and that these artists have a duty to make sure that they, you know, help to defeat the evil Soviets through the use of abstract expressionism. So that is a creation of the CIA. Again, we can see shades of that with Hollywood, where what is the CIA doing essentially in the promotion of abstract expressionism? Well, they're promoting the ideals that they want people to view America as having. So they want people to view America as this place of free enterprise, this place of freedom to do and say whatever you want. It couldn't be farther from the truth for a lot of people. You know, I mean, if you were, you know, black in the 1950s, who gives a shit if, you know, Jackson Pollock gets to do whatever the hell he wants to? And that's the same sentiment in their influence in the early days of Hollywood. The CIA had planted a whole number of agents within Hollywood, and they also utilized people, people that did work in Hollywood that were willing to kind of, sell their souls to the CIA. And, they would do things like they would censor films that had racist depictions. I can't remember his first name. His last name is Alsop. And he was he used to censor a lot of stuff on behalf of the CIA in Hollywood. And he was he was always talking about his movies. They always had to have, quote, well-dressed Negroes, okay, because they didn't want to portray the image that the Soviet Union played up all the time, that America was this bastion of racism. So again, and all of this has to be done covertly. They can't come out and say this. They can't maybe try to embrace these sorts of ideals, and I'm not saying that that's what the CIA has to do, but instead it all has to be kind of covertly, and it all has to be this facade. It doesn't matter if the reality of this is that, well, it actually sucks living in America, there's a lot of poverty, there's a lot of racism, there's a lot of social problems, there's all these sorts of other issues. That doesn't matter, as long as we can project the image, okay, and we can, and by projecting that image, I think in a lot of ways they're also able to convince people that they are living in a world that they may not actually be. And that, in and of itself, is very powerful, and is something that the CIA has always been willing to exploit. So again, average person may not really understand modern art back in the, let's say mid-50s, but they understand that it is something that only exists in America, in the land of the free and the brave. So that's very powerful. Idea, and that's a very if you can convince people of things like that, that is very powerful in and of itself, because then you can kind of get away with whatever you want. So again, while the CIA is promoting whatever the left wing, let's say, with these artists, well, they're also overthrowing Mossadegh, they're overthrowing president of Guatemala, they're training and funding Chiang Kai-shek in Taiwan, they're helping to rebuild the Nazis and fascists all over Europe. They're beginning to get familiar with the heroin trade in Southeast Asia. But again, the outward image is anything but that. And I think that's another important component in this as well. And moreover, it did in a lot of ways benefit them. I'm just going to throw it out there. Soviet art, like paintings and stuff, kind of does suck in the sense that it is all about realism. We're coming up on the break right now. We'll continue this. I hope I'm not boring anybody, but I will be back in a few minutes with more on this. Yeah.
up to the world's meeting place. American.
It's practically narcotic.
Freedom.
Oh, yes, I like very much.
Radio.
You're an American institution.
American Freedom Radio.
Are you feeling embarrassed and stuck because you can't focus or concentrate? I have a confession to make. I spent years unable to think clearly, like I was in a fog. I was going through the motions, running my companies, and I hated feeling groggy and mentally sluggish. I couldn't get ahead like this. It's no secret, the powers that be want us dumbed down. Chemicals, fluoride, our brains are under siege, and we are experiencing lower IQs. But now there's a weapon to fight back and win. Introducing DNA Evolve, a revolutionary breakthrough in a category of cognitive enhancers called nootropics. I've been using DNA Evolve and couldn't feel better. For me, it works. It feels great to get things done again and get ahead. Try a free sample for yourself at DNAEvolveSample.com. That's DNAEvolveSample.com. Supplies are limited, so go to DNAEvolveSample.com right now.
Did you know there are 3 million edible food plants on Earth, and none have the nutritional value of the hemp plant? HempUSA.org offers you hemp protein powder. It does not contain chemicals or THC, is non-GMO, and is 100% gluten-free. Hemp protein powder burns fat, builds muscle, contains 53% protein, and feeds the body the nutrients it needs. Call 888-910-4367 and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org. HempUSA.org introduces 3 brand new detox formulations of micro plant powder. Brain Fuel for depression, bipolar disorders, and stress. Total Care, anti-cancer agent that cleans the liver and organs and increases memory. Rejuvenate, invigorates and heals the body, mind, and spirit. These products are your alternative to pharmaceuticals. Call 888-910-4367 and like us on Facebook. We ship worldwide. Only at HempUSA.org.
What about show business? Show business, completely dishonest, corrupt, and full of shit, but in a nice way. Plenty of expensive drugs and perverted sex. If you're going to be full of shit, might as well enjoy your work. Then you have the media. Not just the news media, let's include them all. The media are almost literally exploding with bullshit because they're located right at the crossroads of all the other bullshit. The media are made up of equal parts advertising, politics, business, public relations, and show business. These people are sitting right at bullshit junction. There's enough bullshit in the media for Texas to open a branch office. And you still have enough left over to start 2 law firms and a Christian bookstore.
What has American Freedom Radio ever done for us?
Provide us for free education?
Well, that's obviously effective, but apart from reversing the dumbing down of America...
All the information they provide is free?
What about the free podium for broadcast activists to speak from, man?
Exploiting commonplace corruption?
They help vulnerable people who don't have a voice?
Bringing light to important information nobody else does.
Well, they never censor, hang up, or cut off their guests.
Well, that's no fun, is it?
Oh, they created a fantastic alternative media source during an era of bad, manipulative, and infiltrated mainstream and alternative media shows and scum.
Okay, well, apart from the free education, free information, free podium for broadcast activists to speak from, exposing commonplace corruption, helping vulnerable people without a voice, bringing light to important information nobody else does, and creating a fantastic commercial-free alternative media source in a sea of bad, manipulative mainstream and alternative media shills and scum, what has American Freedom Radio ever done for us?
Donate to American Freedom Radio today.
No rules, no rules, no taboo topics, no taboo topics, no fear of doom, no fear of doom. We are American Freedom Radio, American Freedom Radio.
Hawkins Policy Radio, offering a unique perspective on everything. Geopolitics, culture creation, the reality of the world we live in. Coming to you live from New York City, your host,
Pierce to Redman.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Porkins Policy Radio. I am your host, Pierce Redman, here on American Freedom Radio. If you are just tuning in, which I thank you, Jenny, for just tuning in right now, I have been discussing the abstract expressionist movement and the influence that the CIA has had on it. And I know that I was really kind of rambling on there in the first hour, so, you know, bear with me. What were we kind of talking about before the break? But this movement that was spontaneous in its initial phases, but which was viewed by the CIA and by those in government as an excellent propaganda tool against the Soviet Union and against the perceived ideals of the Soviet Union. So again, Soviet realism is bad. But abstract expressionism is about liberty. It's about freedom, and free enterprise again. As I was saying, through groups like MoMA, through the Congress for Cultural Freedom, through the Fairfield Foundation, all of these sort of groups, abstract expressionism became it became what modern art is viewed as. Okay, it became what everybody in the art world wanted to talk about, and again, it became very in vogue. It became very chic to collect modern art, to collect abstract expressionist paintings. So again, even though many of these artists ostensibly were left wing or espoused viewpoints, about the common man, about the working class man. Even though Jackson Pollock has this persona of a cowboy, suddenly they're making millions of dollars. Suddenly these, Wall Street bankers need to purchase a Mark Rothko. Okay. It needs to be hanging in their office. The rich and the famous suddenly are, it's very quaint. To have a Jackson Pollock or a de Kooning painting in their house. And there was some backlash to this, okay? So in 1952, for instance, there were about 50 American artists, Edward Hopper, Charles Birchfield, Jack Levine, many others. They actually attacked MoMA in this document that they called the Reality Manifesto. And they attacked them for, quote, coming to be more and more identified in the public eye with abstract and non-objective art, a dogma, okay? And they felt that this stemmed mostly from the Museum of Modern Art and its unquestioned influence throughout the country. And the same year, in 52, when that was published, the Communist Monthly, Masses and Mainstream, also attacked abstract art and what they referred to as the shrine at MoMA in an article called, quote, Dollars, Doodles, and Death. And Francis Connor Saunders, says that was eerily prophetic, and we'll get to why that was so prophetic. But what happens, though? Suddenly, these artists become very wealthy. Many of them were made fun of for, looking like, ad executives and Wall Street men while they're supposed to be, quote, starving artists. And what also happens, the art becomes more expensive. So suddenly it's not uncommon to, start buying, a painting for, tens of thousands, maybe even, $1 million or something like that. The art becomes more elitist. So the people that are supporting the art, the people that are buying this art, are a very elite few. And their influence on that is that, if you want to, if you want to be successful as an artist, and nobody really wants to be a starving artist, nobody wants to be starving, no one wants to be poor. So what happens is that you're going to also begin to create art that speaks to that group of people. And I can say this too, is, I work in the arts, I work in theater, and you're always getting people writing grants and stuff, so that they can fund, you know, a play or something like that. And that's a real, an issue I have with all of this is that it's basically, you're just chasing grant money. But when you are chasing grant money, what happens is that, well, you're going to appeal to the people that have the grant. So again, what starts as spontaneous begins to take a life of its own. The art becomes more expensive. The art becomes more elitist. The art becomes larger than life, both in a figurative and in a literal sense. The art physically becomes bigger. So, you know, you start to see like a Jackson Pollock that takes up, an entire apartment building. You know, they physically, the canvases that they're using become bigger and bigger. Again, I think kind of mimicking the life that they have taken on. And again, as I said, the political leanings and the idealism of many of these artists also begins to change. So, you know, suddenly you have these artists that, you know, were all about the working man, and they all have houses in the Hamptons. They all start wearing expensive suits. They start going to sophisticated parties with, high society in New York City. So they begin to change as well. And I think what I find so fascinating about this is that in a lot of ways, abstract expressionism and modern art more generally becomes an extension of the elites. It becomes a commodity. It becomes art, the way that we view it, almost becomes like a toy for them. It's something that they all want to kind of have a piece of. They all want to show it off to their friends that they were able to afford this, you know, $50,000 Mark Rothko painting. And that is a very fascinating phenomenon, especially given that there seemed to be this sort of brief window in American art post-World War II where that void might have been differently, or taken on a different manifestation. But as I said in the first hour, you have people like Clement Greenberg who are pushing the idea that the elites of America, the rich and the powerful, they must fund this stuff and they must direct it in a certain direction because it's their job. So also what happens is, you know, you begin to see this connection being lost between regular people and art. And I think personally that that's bad for society. I think that's a negative thing. I think that, I think it's very easy for people to go and, you know, you can go to MoMA, you can go to the New Museum, you can go anywhere in New York. And there is a disconnect with a lot of this art. And I think that there's a variety of factors for why that is. But I think that that's bad because that also trickles down. And then we begin to see, certain people in the alternative media and in other places in the alt community begin to have this sort of hatred of art and of modernism in particular. And I think that that's a bad thing because I think what's so fascinating about, let's say, abstract expressionism or abstract art in general is that it can elicit a feeling in you that can't be expressed in, say, a figurative drawing or sculpture. There is a power to this that can, make you think about things, make you think about ideas in a way that you wouldn't be able to if you're, say, looking at a Rembrandt or something a Da Vinci or Cezanne or something like that. There is a power to this art that, again, I think on some level the CIA understood as well. Beyond the political reasons for doing this, I think they also understood that this art has a power that is almost hidden to people. And again, if you really take the time and you look at some of the, you know, abstract expressionist paintings, there is this primal you know, desire or something that can be elicited from it. There is something that you can't put into words. You can't put into even like a physical drawing or something. So, the loss, this loss of connection with everyday people is bad, because then what happens is people begin to reject it. They begin to want to censor it. And, you know, as I said too, much of this art and the artists themselves, they begin to mirror the people that are funding them and that are buying them. So they begin to mirror the elites in the world. And I hope that this will kind of bring it back. But, you know, I mentioned at the very beginning of this, you know, there's been a lot of scrutiny targeted at art recently in relation to the scandal, which shall remain nameless right now. I think, again, that people don't fully understand how the art world works. And they don't understand that in a lot of ways, the way that, you know, abstract expressionism sort of set in many ways the groundwork for how contemporary art has morphed into the phenomenon that it is today. So, you know, contemporary artists now are, you know, they're part of the 1%. They are the elite, because the only people that can afford it are the elitists. And again, contemporary art has become larger physically in scale, and it's become, more sought after. It's become more and more expensive. And I think in some ways that's not necessarily, you look at someone, let's say, like a Marina Abramović, let's actually skip that. Let's look at Louise Bourgeois, okay, who is a very famous artist, associated, I guess, with like the feminist art movement, but also abstract expressionism. She has a very famous sculpture called the Arc of Hysteria. And this does hang in Tony Podesta's house. Now, it is a provocative-looking sculpture. You can go and Google it and look at it. It's it does look disturbing. It was made in 1993. And I've seen all of these people on the internet pointing to, that Bourgeois made that because of Jeffrey Dahmer. Okay, because Jeffrey Dahmer would pose his victims in these contorted positions. And there is one of Dahmer's victims was posed in a position that looks just like the Arc of Hysteria. The Arch of Hysteria, excuse me. But that's not what that's about. What Bourgeois is really commenting on is the idea of the hysterical woman, or of the idea of hysteria. And the figure in that has no head. It has no genitalia. It does look masculine, but it's sort of, it can be whatever you want to think of it as. And that's not necessarily what she's doing. And I think people need to kind of like take a step back and understand that's not quite what that art has become, but we've rejected so much of contemporary art that we can't look at something like that and not think that there's some sort of secret, you know, this is about Jeffrey Dahmer. There's no way that that's what Louise Bourgeois was thinking of when she made that. But let's look at Marina Abramović, very controversial artist. I dislike her art intensely. But you know, is she creating performance pieces and other things that she knows will attract a certain type of rich elitist? Absolutely. Because that is what art has become. It has become about chasing money. And it has become about becoming more and more shocking. And again, you can look at the roots of that even in the abstract expressionist movement. Now, I don't think that they were trying to necessarily create shock art, but it certainly was shocking to the aesthetics and tastes of people of that time. It was certainly controversial when viewed through the lens of, you know, European aesthetics. And group of very powerful men and women behind the scenes helped to promote this. They helped to make it into what it has now become. And the legacy of that, I think, has trickled down to other. So then you can look at, like, you know, Jeff Koons, who's a complete psycho, makes god awful art, sells it for millions and millions of dollars. I mean, he's probably a billionaire. And his art is only really purchased by people that are fellow billionaires. And what fills the void? You know, if we're going to reject all this sort of art, if we're going to find that it is, you know, it needs to be censored and whatnot, what's the alternative that people are offering? What's the answer to all of that? And that's a question I think that you know, I guess I'll pose to everybody out there listening to the alternative community. That this is a question that I think we should really be pondering, because art is important to a society, and it is something that I think we should all enjoy. And that doesn't mean that we all have to like modern art. You know, there's a ton of modern art I despise, or contemporary art that I hate. I do like, you know, Rembrandt and Monet and stuff like, you know, I'm not saying that classical art or, you know, Renaissance art is something that we need to poo-poo, but the way that people are now jumping to the conclusion that all of these artists are part of some sort of dark cabal, when really, is this a legacy of what in part began in the 1950s? In that, in the promotion of this by a certain group of people, in the way that it's become more and more sought after and more expensive, so that only a certain group of people can purchase this art, does that influence the art? Does that influence the type of people making art? I think it does. And I think that's something that we need to understand, and we need to not dismiss all of this. You know, I think, you know, are there some stuff that some paintings in Tony Podesta's house that are that I find disturbing and shouldn't be seen? I guess so. Yeah. I mean, you know, the Serbian painter is not my cup of tea. But when we start censoring art and stuff, even like that, then we open ourselves up for all sorts of repercussions. You know, who begins to say what's acceptable and what's not? You know, we had this in New York City back in the 90s with Giuliani and the whole degenerate art show that was going on, and he wanted to get rid of it. And he, you know, and it's, that's a scary thing, you know, especially given that, you know, the Nazis had a, you know, their whole, they hated degenerate art, you know, banned art and things like that. So I mean, I know I'm kind of like all over the place right now with what I'm saying, but I think that in a lot of ways, to kind of like sum up that idea, we need to kind of take a closer look at this. We need to understand this, and we need to in some ways confront this. While it is widely known that the CIA was involved in MoMA and in the Abstract Expressionist movement, I don't think it's widely known enough. And I don't think that people kind of fully understand the ramifications of that influence in terms of creating this extension of the elite in terms of artists. And, you know, and you know, what happened to the people that kind of started this movement, that had perhaps had a political ideology or had a desire to influence society? Well, you know, Jackson Pollock dies in a car crash in 56. Arshil Gorky hangs himself, I think, in the same year. Franz Klein, another abstract expressionist, drinks himself to death. That's about 6 years later. 65, the sculptor David Smith dies in a car crash. In 1970, Mark Rothko opens up his veins and bleeds to death on his studio floor. And all of them did become the very thing that they sort of feared and hated. They did become obsessed with materialism. They did become obsessed with making money, with being famous, and all of these sort of things. And I think, again, that all of that has trickled down or trickled up, in terms of how art is created and how art is sold to people. And that's really bad, because that's not what art shouldn't be about that. Now, obviously, art has always been, there have always been artists that are going to be funded by the rich. The rich are going to have the money to support artists, and that is a reality. And that's something that, you know, we just sort of have to accept. But that doesn't mean that all art is like that. And that doesn't give us the right to start determining what's good art, what's bad art, what needs to be censored, what doesn't need to be censored. And again, what's the alternative? What fills that void? And I see a lot of people rejecting art. Of course, you can find all of my work at PorkinsPolicyReview.com, and I will be talking to you all next week.
Information you can trust. This is American Freedom Radio. Freedom, freedom, American Freedom Radio. Radio. American Freedom Radio.